Good morning. Good to see everybody back again for a third day. Need to first of all check and see if you're awake. You don't have to write it down. I won't come around and check everybody's paper, but I'll take a hand or two from Mindtrap. How many cubic meters of dirt are in a hole 6 meters long, 2 meters wide, quiet over there, and 1 meter deep? So let me just give the dimensions again. 6 meters long, 2 meters wide, and 1 meter deep. All right, I saw that hand back there in the back. Zero, yeah. If it's not a hole, if it's filled with dirt. So we'll see how good I am on the long throw here. All right, let's go one more here for you mathematicians. If you divide 30 by half and add 10, what is the answer? There you go. All the hands go up way in the back. Oh, there's somebody in the front. I can reach them with a throw. Sorry. If you divide 30 by half and add 10, what is the answer? The answer is? 70. All right. A lot of people divide it by 2 instead of a half. So, all right. Science one yet. If you were to step into a sealed room filled with 100% methane gas and strike a match, what would happen? Yes, sir. That's right. Nothing. You need oxygen for the explosion. All right. Oh, long throw. My bad. All right. Well, everybody's awake, so we'll jump right in. Relating to patron families in the local church, let me grab my little clicker here. A little bit like the first morning, I'm going to take the long way around to get there, because I think there's a prerequisite stop that we need to make before we get to specifics of relating to patron families and the local church. I think we first need to stop and take a look at the word authority. Because until we understand authority and are under authority, we will have trouble being in authority. All of you as teachers will be in authority, which is a very serious position to be in. But unless we really understand what it's about and are in our proper place in the line, we tend to either abuse our authority or else not use it properly. So first of all, are we under authority? Well, there's lots of authorities we're under. We're obviously under God. All of us are. We're under a local church. I assume we all have a local congregation, and whether you're teaching in your home area or at a different area, you have your home church and then possibly also the church where you're in the area where you're teaching. If you're in a school, many schools are sponsored by a local church. If not, there's typically a group of pastoral advisors that bring the influence of the local church. We're under the legal authorities. All of us face that. Many different legal requirements on us, both education-wise and other ways. Your school board, group of maybe 5-7 men that meet at least once a month to discuss the school, you're responsible to them. Typically, you'll answer to the person that's under them in the chain of command, the administrator or principal. Your parents. You know, I'm somewhere in my 30s. I told somebody I was one age in the 30s, and then I was relating that to my family, and they said, no, you aren't that age. You're older. And I was confused. I should check my license more often. But even though I'm somewhere in my 30s, I'm still under my parents' authority. Now, as the head of a home, God has given me certain authority, but I still am commanded by God to honor my father and mother. And the scripture does not put in parentheses until age 18. I'm commanded to honor them for life. And so there's a certain level of authority that they bring to my life as long as they're alive. And while they don't usually go around commanding me to do things, I recognize that God works through authority. And I value, I hang on to their counsel, because that is the way God wants to give me wisdom. And the parents of your students, you'll work under their authority as a teacher. In my school, we have about 100 families, two parents per family. That's 200 bosses I have. My parents, 202. My wife's parents, 204. The administrator doesn't work, but the school board does. 211. Local church, three pastoral advisors. I'm at 214. I have 214 bosses. If you left your last job because you didn't get along with your boss, you came to the wrong profession. We have a lot of bosses as teachers. And we need to understand this and respect it and work within that structure of authority. For scripture, I just want to turn over to Matthew 8 and take a look there. Jesus just commenting on a non-Jew who understood the principle of authority. And when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came unto him a centurion, beseeching him, and saying, Lord, my servant lieth at home, sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. And Jesus saith unto him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that thou shouldest come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. For I am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this man, go, and he goeth. And to another, come, and he cometh. And to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled, and said to them that followed, verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith. No, not in Israel. And I say unto you that many shall come from the east and west, and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the children of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said unto the centurion, go thy way, and as thou hast believed, so be it done unto thee. And his servant was healed in the selfsame hour. The centurion got it. God works through authority. He has set up the local church. He has set up the structure within our schools. He set up family structures. And God uses imperfect people in those structures to do his work. You have the Apostle Paul respecting the authorities in Rome who were going to kill him. And yet respecting them and saying, we need to give them due honor. And so, even though the authorities that fill these positions are certainly not perfect, we need to give them the respect that they deserve. And we need to understand that as we work within the framework of authority, that is how we can be most effective in God's kingdom. There's freedom in being under authority. I would be lost without my board, because that gives me tremendous freedom. I don't always agree with my board, but I understand they're my authority. And if I stick my neck out and do something they don't want me to do, I'm on my own. And I'm going to take the consequences. But as long as I'm working under their authority, I just have this freedom because I'm doing what my authority wants me to do. If there's a problem, I take it right back to my authority. I mean, obviously, I'm supposed to solve a lot of problems before it gets there, but that's who I have to fall back to. My parents, even as an adult, as I know that I'm living a life that pleases them and I'm honoring them, tremendous freedom. My life has been blessed unspeakably by the relationship that I have with my parents. as I know that they're behind me and backing me up. There's just tremendous protection in being under authority. You know, if you're out and living in Tornado Alley and you have some sort of a shelter to go when tornadoes come along, you know, you have safety as you go into shelter. But when you see the tornado coming towards you and you go outside and say, well, the Lord promised to take care of me. Does God's promise apply at this point? Yeah, He promised to take care of you, but you're being very unwise. You're tempting Him. And, you know, you just may go whoosh. And yet, and God has provided protection for you from temptation. And He's provided this structure, this shelter called authority. And as long as you're in that shelter, there's tremendous protection for you. But people say, oh, I was tempted. I couldn't resist the temptation. God said He'd help me. But I walked out of the shelter and I'm standing out here in the winds. Just tremendous danger in stepping out of God's authority, out from God's framework of authority. So I'm just challenging all of us, myself included, as I've worked on this, I've been challenged a lot myself to think about how I'm submitting, particularly in reference to our local churches. There's an interesting article a brother here gave to me. It was in Christianity Today. It's called A Family Affair by Joseph Hellerman. And he talks about how we grow spiritually as we stay in the crucible of a community. And I'm just going to read a few paragraphs. Spiritual formation occurs primarily in the context of community. Persons who remain connected with their brother and sister in the local church almost invariably grow in self-understanding. And they mature in their ability to relate in healthy ways to God and to fellow human beings. This is especially the case for those courageous Christians who stick it out through the messy process of interpersonal conflict. Long-term relationships are the crucible of genuine progress in the Christian life. People who stay grow. People who leave do not grow. Now, I'll stick in a caveat there. I mean, there's sometimes an environment in which, for whatever reason, it is not working. And, you know, I think we all have to decide, what is the brotherhood that I can live with? And once you've said, this is the framework that I believe I can live with and that God is calling me to commit yourself to that and not to leave because there's some small wind that goes along. And that's primarily what I'm referring to is interpersonal conflict, the things that come up, perhaps not massive framework issues. We all know persons consumed with spiritual wanderlust. We never get to know them well because they cannot seem to stay put. They move from church to church, avoiding conflict or ever searching for a congregation that will better satisfy their felt needs. Like trees repeatedly transplanted from soil to soil, these spiritual nomads fail to put down roots, and they seldom experience lasting, fruitful growth in their Christian lives. Despite what we know about spiritual growth, nearly all churches in America are characterized by an unwillingness of members to commit themselves deeply to their respective church. For some, it means church hopping. For most, it means keeping the church at arm's length. That is, living as if the individual's life is primary and that of the church is secondary. I experienced this firsthand not many years ago when my church went through a time of struggle. There was a serious issue. And the primary parties were the pastor and another member who I respected. And I was in the unique position of being able to see both sides fairly clearly and to understand both sides and see why they were both where they were at, but also to see that they just could not get together. And so I could look at the pastor's side and I understand, yeah, See why he's doing what he's doing? I can look at the church member's side and say, yeah, I understand why he's doing what he's doing. And as I watched this boil over months, perhaps into over a year, years, it got worse. And that was a tough thing for me. I had training as a lay counselor. I had probably 40 hours of mediation training. And, you know, I sit there and watch this dispute. And finally, as it got very serious, I called my pastor and talked to this other church member, and I asked him to come over to my house if we could sit down and talk about it. And I really credit my pastor for being humble enough to let me, the peon that I am, try and mediate this. But we sat down in my basement and we chatted for quite a time. And it seemed like there was a breakthrough where maybe the issue didn't exactly go away, but they had a chance to sense each other's heart. And I had hope when I saw them catching each other's heart. So I was very excited, sat down, had a meal. But by the next morning, events had transpired that completely erased everything that had happened at my house the evening before. And that was rather crushing to me. And I was disillusioned. And I said, maybe it's time to move on. Because it was hard for me to function in the framework of that local church. I said to Starla, you know, I just can't see clearly right now. Right now I need to get some perspective. So for a number of months, we visited whenever we had the opportunity, just to give some distance and to back away. But after, I don't know, 6 months, a year, the picture started coming back into focus. I started seeing that the grass wasn't so much greener in the other options. And I started to see that I really did love my church. That there was a lot of good there. But I sort of had this mentality, if my pastor, if my bishop, you know, I think they made a mistake in there somewhere. And I think I went into this with the mentality that if my pastor or my bishop makes a mistake, you know, I really can't follow them. But I started to say, wait a minute. Just assuming they did make a mistake, can I still follow them? And the answer was, yes, I think I can still follow them. I can say, boy, my bishop made a mistake, my pastor made a mistake, but I'm okay with still following them. And that gave me freedom, because I'm going to make mistakes. And I just hope they extend the same grace to me. And so over the course of a year, year and a half, maybe into 2 years, I found myself staying with a deeper level of commitment than I had before that crisis occurred. Which takes me back to that last sentence in the first paragraph of that article. People who stay grow. That's what happened for me. And every situation is different. I'm not here to judge your situation. But I'm here to challenge you. God has set up authority. Do your best to stay within that authority, because it is a place in the crucible of a brotherhood where it's messy and there's relationship issues and there's tough things to work through. It's where we grow. What authority do you have? That's a Latin phrase up there, and I'm not convinced I got it right. I pulled it somewhere, and then I wanted to check my source, and I couldn't have my source anymore. In loco parentis, there's a Latin phrase, something like that, which describes the authority you have. In Spanish, loco means crazy, so something about the crazy parent, right? Oh, wait, we're in Latin. It's something about in place of the parent. That is your position as a teacher. The parent has primary responsibility for their child. But the parent is coming to you and saying, hello, teacher. I am turning my child over to you for a time, and I'm giving a part of my authority to you to do what I'm charged to do, and that is teach my child. So I'm subcontracting that to you for a time. And there's an authority that comes with that. So you have this in place of parent responsibility.
And that's a very serious one. But you're in that position of a subcontractor. So you really always have to keep looking back to the authority over that child. And that's the parent. And it requires us to be very humble in dealing with families. I get frustrated with parents sometimes, and most teachers do, sooner or later. They don't all think exactly like I do. But it's our responsibility to respect them, because we're assisting them in doing their job.
Speaking to parents, just a couple of... Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. A couple of things. As we speak to parents, you'll find as a teacher, if you stick around very long, that the difference between a poor teacher and a good teacher so often is very small. And a beginner can't even really sometimes tell the difference because, you know, when I was in student teaching, my mentor could go and say things to a student, and then I could go and imitate him and say what I thought was exactly the same thing, and it would blow up in my face. But some of it is the relationship you establish, but some of it is very small nuances in how you word things. And this is only learned by experience. So have fun learning. Also, parents will sense your attitude. If you're under authority, if you have a respect for them, it'll open doors for you. That you could say the same things, but if you have an attitude of disrespect lurking under the surface, people will react to. The one I love to talk about is putting money in the bank. You need to put money in the bank when it comes to dealing with people in order to be effective. Let me see what's next up here. Oh, wrong one. I think I have a slide with that later. It goes back to rapport that we talked about yesterday. You need to build that rapport with the students so that you have something to draw on when you have a difficult thing comes up. The same is with parents. If you don't invest something positive into the relationship, when the time comes to deal with something negative, you're very likely to get reaction. But as you invest positive things into any given relationship, there's something there to draw on when the time comes to deal with something negative. I had a brand new teacher a few years ago who came into the classroom and did a home run job of putting money in the bank. One of the benefits of getting your teachers to copy on all their major emails home is then you can steal them and, you know, bring them back anonymously years later. And so I changed the names in this email, and I want to read for you an email one of my teachers, first-year teacher, sent within the first 2 weeks of school to the parent of her most challenging student. I think it was in response to an email she'd received from this parent. So, "Dear Sandra, thanks for your email and your encouragement." It's a fairly long email. "I must be honest, it brought tears to my eyes when I read that Jason has enjoyed my teaching and that you pray for me. I've had a wonderful week so far, but I was feeling like I needed some encouragement today. Thanks for letting God use you to meet that need. Thank you, too, for your information on Jason and some suggestions from previous years. That information is very helpful. I believe parents and teachers are a team, and therefore I'm always open to suggestions. Thus far, I found Jason to be very cooperative, and polite student. He has a wonderful attitude towards school and learning. In fact, he got very excited during our science lesson today on life cycles. He was very involved in the lesson. He has also done a good job of making the transition back into our classroom when he comes back from the learning support teacher. Sometimes we're in the middle of an activity when he comes back, but he patiently waits for my instructions and does his very best to follow them." They were in the honeymoon period. "I've discussed Jason's needs with both the previous year's teacher and the learning support teacher. Both of them shared valuable insights with me. In addition, I did review the evaluation in his file. I do have him seated in the front center of my classroom. I was not aware of the spelling difficulties. I would like to have him take the regular test for the next two Fridays to see how it goes. I want to do this just to let him try.
because I understand that he is becoming sensitive to being different. At the same time, I don't want him to become discouraged. If he finds the spelling difficult, I would reduce the number of words he needs to learn or give a different list. For Bible memory, I will allow him to say that to you at home, because the important thing is that he knows it. However, when we take the test in class, I will let him try it, but I won't grade it. Since he is sensitive to being different, I don't want to say,
everyone will be doing Bible memory, and Jason, you will be reading a book.
Again, if Jason is overwhelmed and discouraged by doing it in class, I won't force him to. I really try hard to make all my students feel successful, but keep the same requirements. Please keep me updated on things in the classroom that are overwhelming him. Please also let me know if Jason is struggling with feeling different. I will do my best to praise him for all the wonderful qualities he shows. I'm looking forward to working with your family. Thanks for communicating with me. Signed by my brand new teacher. That gal was a millionaire. She had money in the bank. She went on to become a star teacher. We're still working at forgiving her because her and her husband decided to have a baby, and I worked hard to persuade her that she should bring the baby in on her back and just keep teaching, but it didn't work out. But she made a huge deposit with one of her most challenging students' families right off the bat. And it paid off for her. Money in the bank. I've worked with another teacher over the course of the years that wasn't a natural at putting money in the bank. And the particular position they had assigned to them did not make it extra easy to put money in the bank. And yet their position required them to do lots of withdrawals, deal with lots of negative behaviors. And this teacher got reaction, and tried to lower the boom. Authority. Yeah. But students are learning that authority thing. And what they felt is this boom coming down on them and overdrawn bank accounts. And, you know, it's tough to coach someone in how to make bank deposits if they're not accustomed to doing it. Because they just see this reaction. I'm getting bad attitudes. These people are rebelling against me. But sometimes when you're running into those walls, take a moment to turn around and make sure that you don't have an overdrawn account. Speaking to parents, do keep a positive tone. I asked my teachers this last year. I didn't really follow through with it. I had meant it to make it something we'd address at an in-service. But I asked them to get a piece of paper and just put it somewhere, tape it to their desk or somewhere, and just kind of keep track of their interactions with parents. A positive column, a negative column, and a neutral column. And just kind of see for themselves where they're coming out with communication. Because, you know, if everything's in the negative column, we have a problem. And if nothing else, it just made the teachers think about it a little bit. You know, what percentage of my contacts to parents are negative? We hope that there's at least a balance in the two columns. Number two, feed sandwiches to parents. Bologna's best, no. I get to lead lots of parent meetings. And it always makes me nervous if I know a teacher sees the cup as half empty and that teacher is coming into a meeting, because they tend to want to really just state things in negative terms. And parents don't respond well to things that are stated in purely negative terms. They love their child. They're investing their life in their child. And they need to hear that you see good in their child. Because if when they walk in for that meeting, they're nervous, they're scared of you, and if all they hear is something negative about their child, it's hard for them to focus on the issue because they're wondering about your intent. But if you come in and you're able to say, boy, your child is really excelling in this, and I'm really happy with the progress they're making over here. We do have a little issue over here. And you address it. That's why you call the meeting. And you deal with it. You're direct about it. But then, if at all possible, say, well, you know, again, if we can just replicate the success we're having over here, boy, we can clear this up. Get much better results from parents if you feed them sandwiches. Understand that the child is the parent's most prized possession. You know, until I became a parent, I didn't understand what went into this. How many sleepless nights there are. I mean, mostly for my wife, but yeah, she's very kind to me. But how much lost sleep and effort and money and time. We just pour our lives into our children. And you don't have the same emotional connection to that student that I as a parent do. They're our most precious possession. And if I sense a negative attitude toward my child, I'm going to react because they're my treasure. Use we, not you. Well, what you need to do to solve this problem with your child is what we need to do to find a solution to this problem is one word different, slightly different tone, completely different reaction. Quickly get to a solution. You call a parent in and say, we have a problem. But then you don't have a solution. You don't have some suggestions. And there's been a time or so where I've gotten some tough cookies, and I've sat there and we really have flat-out brainstormed solutions. But you don't want to call a parent meeting, get on the phone with the parent, unless you've already thought through one or two possible solutions to a problem. Because if you're just sitting there saying, we have a problem, we really have a problem, you really do have a problem. Be quick to apologize. Now, you can be too quick. Make sure there is something to apologize for. Because when I have a teacher that falls over themselves apologizing when they really, really did nothing wrong, that doesn't work real well either. But if there's any kind of culpability in a situation where you really should have done this, or you should have caught that, or you should have notified the parents sooner, you know, be quick to say, boy, I'm sorry, that was my bad. I'm going to work it doing better in that. Parents respect an humble spirit. Use your rubber sword. I already alluded to it, but parents are often very intimidated by coming to meet you. And likewise, many times we're very intimidated by going to meet the parents. They're scary. And whenever we can walk into a meeting like that, and break that ice with a little bit of humor. And I go in and I try hard to find out. I have about 100 families and I don't keep track of it, all the dad's professions. But, you know, chat about their profession. Something. Learn what's going on in their family. Just, you know, a little crack about the weather. Something breaks that ice and opens doors. Finally, keep the well-being of the student at the center of the conversation. As parents see that you really care and that you're really working for their child's good, it's putting money in the bank and it covers a multitude of faults. Because as they see your heart, it allows you to connect with the parents. Speaking to parents, I had the do's now for two don'ts. Don't tell a parent their student is bad. Yeah, don't tell their parent, the student's parent, yeah. Don't tell a parent that their student is bad, stupid, or unable to learn, or any other words that might describe that. Very, very often you will find a parent says, oh, I had the same trouble in school. Johnny hates math, and I did too. I was awful. And if you say things that are condemning about that student, you're not condemning the student, you're condemning the parent. They're all of a sudden feeling like they're the little guy that's in trouble in the chair. Be very careful about making judgmental statements. You're always saying we're having difficulty with this issue, not the student can't do this. We have a little struggle over here that we need to address. Here's some ways maybe we could help that. Don't be too blunt. Your student needs help. Your student may need help, but bluntness, speaking the truth bluntly, gets reaction. And again, it's just learning how to just soften those words just a little bit and take that edge off. And that's why it's so critical to have letters or emails home reviewed by, you know, a co-teacher or your administrator, because a lot of times they just catch, ooh, that word's not wrong, it's truthful, but it just has a little edge to it, and it hurts. And again, you can do a lot of damage when you're just a little too blunt. Okay, here was my money in the bank when it was just a little bit out of order here. How do you put money in the bank? You contact parents early before negatives come up. Making it a point as much as possible. You know, you have 20 students in your class, doing your best to somehow in the first 2-3 weeks of school get a positive contact with the families of your students. To build in routine ways of sending home encouraging notes. So, you know, maybe you have a little system where they take turns. You rotate through the class, and every week you pick one student you send a note home with, and you search for something good in them. Or maybe you have a merit system. But to somehow build into your personal system a way of getting encouraging notes home. And number 3, pick up the phone. As a teacher, I hated making phone calls. I was scared of parents. And a lot of other teachers are too. But the phone is such a powerful tool. It takes a little time to look up the phone number, to call them up and say, you know, boy, Johnny just had an insight today in devotions. It was just wonderful. And I just wanted to affirm what you're doing in your family because something good is happening. Don't want to always think about money, but you did just make a nice deposit. But you also really encouraged that parent, and you also really encouraged that student, because they're likely to hear about it now from mom and dad. Try to gain a parent's perspective. It's fascinating that I find that a lot of young students, kindergarten, first grade, often behave better for teachers than for their parents. Now, as they get older, that can kind of reverse. But, you know, these children are growing up and, you know, kindergarten, and they've been at home with mom 24/7 for the last, you know, 5-6 years. And, you know, sometimes mom and the child get a little tired of each other and they're a little too familiar. And, you know, so there's, you know, they don't always obey right away. And when they go into a new environment, you know, where there's the teacher, first cousin to God, you know, in their mind. And, you know, it's kind of intimidating. And a lot of times, you know, I just had a parent in my office 2 or 3 weeks ago. You know, and they said they sent their child to school, and their child was a terror at home. And, you know, and so they kept probing the teacher, you know, does he do this? Does he do that? What about, and, you know, as a teacher, if you don't have children of your own, you're saying, why are they asking these questions? I mean, what do they think I'm doing? You know, it'd be easy to get really defensive, but it may be they're just saying, I can't believe how well my child's behaving. You know, so sometimes there's parent perspectives that are good insight. Realize the parent's goals and partner with them. One of my teachers really encouraged me this last year with an email about my daughter. Early this year, we had been over at my 80-year-old neighbor's house, and they had their television there, and there was something on, and so I watched that as we're there, and it was an incredible reminder of why I don't have a television. I'm very strong. I would not want a television in my home. I'm thrilled I don't have a television in my home, so I don't really watch television. But as I was over at my old neighbor's house there, and I saw this particular event, I was just vexed. I had forgotten how bad TV is. And I was just stunned by the garbage. And my children were there with me, and I got home, and I was just, wow. And at that time, my oldest daughters were 5 and 7, and I just felt compelled to talk to them about what we'd just seen. But it's like, I mean, they really aren't going to get this. Now, you understand, girls, you know, the reason we don't have TV is because of this, 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 and this. And, you know, we do not want this. You know, it does look interesting because of this, this, and this. But here's why. You know, it's like giving a little daddy lecture. And it's like, shoo, I'm sure that went right over the top. But maybe about 2 months later, I got this email from the teacher. I wanted to encourage you and Starla. You are teaching your daughters well. Yesterday, one of the children was talking about watching movies, and Sierra defended her position very well about not watching many movies or TV. She did it politely, but she knew why she doesn't and explained it well. I agreed with her. I think sometimes parents wonder if their teaching is working. Yours is. You want to make a principal cry? Send him an email like that. Wow. The teacher was a partner in doing what Starla and I care about most, training our daughter rightly. Look at the big picture. We tend to get hammered with frustrations, and as a result, become very frustrated with the student. And we want to talk to the parent about our frustration and get it solved. But we do need to keep a bigger perspective. You know, is this a major character issue or is this a frustration? Because sometimes we let frustrations become very big. And they're really, in the big picture, not a huge deal. But sometimes there's major character flaws going on with students. But because they're not frustrating us, we let them slide. And we need to partner with the parents in looking for major things. You know, in the big picture, is this child becoming a godly person? And is this an anomaly in that big picture? Or do we really, really have a very serious issue? Keep proper perspective. Parent meetings. This could be parent-teacher conferences. This could be other meetings that are called. I'm very, very strong. At Conestoga, they really asked us to do this. And I wasn't really comfortable praying with parents every time we had a meeting. But because I was forced to, it became part of my routine. And I wouldn't trade it. And I now force my teachers to. There's something about a parent hearing you pray for their child. Whatever reason there's a meeting. And I know it can get monotonous when I have 15 parent conferences in a day or whatever it is, or 2 days. But pray with every parent as they come in. They come in, thank you for coming, glad you could be here. Let's just start with a word of prayer. And pray for that student by name, thanking them for the gifts God's given them and asking for wisdom for this conversation. You know, it's really hard to go and tear into the teacher right after they just got done pouring their heart out for your child. Now, that's an ulterior motive. But I like that one. But the serious one is God blesses that. If you, in sincerity, ask God to come into those little conversations, God blesses that. And it just sets the tone for the entire meeting. Very, very important thing to do. Get into a parent meeting. You know, what do parent meetings look like? What do you do? Well, you got to say, you know, the reason we call this meeting is, well, you know, we're having a little struggle right here. And I always try to flip it over to the parent as quickly as I can. If they've got something bottled up, I stand there and talk for 15 minutes, and they have something that's really pressing, they're not going to hear a word I say till they get it out. So I try and flip it over to the parent as quick as I can. And a lot of times the parents, well, we really don't have a lot to say. That's fine. We still called the meeting for a reason. Then, you know, the teacher's perspective. Here's what's been going on in class. Again, you can feed them a sandwich right here. Come prepared. You know, don't never walk into a meeting with a parent or get on a phone conversation with a parent without doing your homework. You don't make a phone call to a parent without sitting down and thinking through how this conversation should go. Preparation is very important. Come prepared with questions. Whenever you're interacting with a parent, you're wanting to learn as well as to gain give information. Together make a plan of action. And, you know, it depends. In a parent-teacher conference, you may not do this, but in any kind of a specially called meeting, I try and get a written report of the meeting. Document what happened, because 2 months later, you won't remember the meeting. Boy, what did we talk about? What did we decide? So helpful to get a little documentation whenever you meet with a parent. Or even a phone call. If something important is going on, you're dealing with a major issue, jot a couple notes. Have a file on your computer where you can just stick it in there. The church. I don't have a lot to say about the church. I wish I could get a pastor up to cover this little section. But we truly believe that we're partners as a school with both the church and the home. And we need to act like partners. We need to be working together. We need to be intentionally thinking about how we can complement the other two and to help them be more effective. Help your students, in regard to the church, understand authority and submission. Teach respect. Model how you relate to leaders. You know, when you comment on what the preacher said on Sunday, you know, if it really was funny, it's okay to laugh, but make sure that you're not saying things in a way that'll belittle a leader of the church. Teach loyalty to the local brotherhood. It seems like so many of our young people are blindsided when they get out into church life. They're 19, 20, 21, 23 years old, and they find a difficult situation that disillusions them with the church. And they're shocked by that. They shouldn't be. We should be preparing them. Folks, if you're going to hang out in the fellowship of believers, you're going to get offended. You're going to get hurt. There's going to be major issues. People are going to make mistakes. Leaders are going to make mistakes. Get used to it. This is how character is built. Another article, Christianity Today. It's called Suburban Spirituality. We're talking about suburban churches and edited it just a little bit. And I'll read a bit. For all the problems, which at their worst include poor preaching, political infighting, self-centeredness, stagnation, special interest groups, the local church is still the most fertile environment for spiritual development. Genuine spiritual progress doesn't happen without a long-term attachment to a local church. I'm all for improving the organization of a local church to make it more biblically effective, but the maddening frustration that prompts someone to leave one church for another may be the precise thing that holds great potential for spiritual progress. If one stays, only that fellowship which faces such disillusionment with all its unhappy and ugly aspects begins to be what it should be in God's sight, begins to grasp in faith the promise that is given to it. Disillusionment with one's church, then, is not reason to leave, but a reason to stay and see what God will create in one's life and in the local church. What I perceive to be my needs, I need a church with a more biblical preacher who uses specific examples from real life, may not correspond to my true spiritual needs. Often, I'm not attuned to my true spiritual needs. Thinking that I know my true needs is arrogant. Staying put as a life practice, allows God's grace to work on the unsanded surfaces of my inner life. A 17th century writer wrote, "Slowly you will learn that all the troubles in your life, your job, your health, we could add your church, and your inward failings, are really cures to the poison of your old nature. Teach respect. Teach loyalty. Don't let your students be blindsided by the troubles that are sure to come. Build bridges to church. You know, every time you can get a pastor in to speak, both in his role as a pastor, but maybe in a less formal role, about his occupation or something else, other representatives of the church, you know, get the superintendent in, get him to talk about what goes on in his mind. And strengthen your connection to the local leadership. You know, guys, to meet with your pastor, to take your pastor out for a meal, to invite him over, to call him up and ask him about an issue. Gals, to connect with your pastor's wife. They are a team. They do share a lot of wisdom. To connect with your ministry. To encourage your pastor's wife. To bring her into your life. To open up your life to her. Just two little assignments that I have run across. As I think about how can we build bridges to the church, I had one teacher that gave an assignment. It was in a class, upper level class, where they were doing audio editing, and I loved the assignment he gave. He said, "Okay, your assignment is to take a sermon from church, figure out what the real point of the message was, edit that 40-minute sermon down to 3 minutes, and then take it to your pastor and play it for him." Tell me that wouldn't force you to interact with that sermon on a tremendously deep level. I don't know what the result would be. I never did hear any results from that class, but that intrigued me. Maybe you could edit it down to 15 minutes from 45. But to force a student to really interact with the sermon and to understand what's going on in there. Another idea is maybe a typing class, to good typing practice, to take a sermon and ask them to transcribe it. Listen to that, type it out, and then give it to the pastor. Good check for the pastor, see how many times he used But, you know, just things, looking for creative things. And I think you all could probably come up with many better ideas than the ones I've given. But just to intentionally think about, how can I build bridges to the local church? I hope that the few ideas that I presented today have encouraged you to think about where you are in God's structure of authority, and have also piqued your thinking as you think about how to relate to parents and creative ways to build bridges to the local church. God bless.